Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday, the 13th of December. Very nice to have you on the program. And we're going to introduce everybody. I first want to remind you that you can be a part of our conversation. All you have to do is check in. panel@wamc.org Rich just got up and I thought you were going to start to dance and I was like, there's no music playing right now. Well, man,
I want to see dance to banjo enough. Music
Was that Tony Trischka?
Nope.
No, that was Bela Fleck. That was Bela Fleck. We had Tony on yesterday, so Bela's on today. That's cool. Excellent.
And in my interview with him, I asked him who was the best banjo player in the world, because we've heard it for both of them, Bela and Tony Trischka. And he was very humble and deferential.
I thought that was a great interview. That was fun to listen to.
Well, he's a great guy.
There's a whole bunch of events, and we have the website, or we have the event and the interview up on our website. So, good morning, everybody. Let me introduce Rich Honan is here, corporate attorney to the stars, and whoever, I don't know who you represent, but I'm sure they pay you well and everything's fine. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Very nice to have you on the program. Hi. Vera Acarius-Kelly joins us. She is a Siena College professor of comparative politics, and always a pleasure to have her on our Thursday program. Good morning.
Pleasure for me as well. Thanks.
It's been a little while. We miss him, so he's back. TU columnist, or Times Union, as we say, Chris Churchill is with us.
Hello.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you. And WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, looking fetching in his sweater, I must say.
It's Irish wool from the Aran Islands.
It's very lovely. Nice. It's very nice. Yeah.
Roselle said you're
that's why he's wearing a turtleneck underneath.
Roselle said you're an old man and you've never had a sweater in your life. So I'm getting one for you.
Very nice. It looks good.
No, it does look good.
Mm-hmm. And,
look good.
And appropriate for the Brexit conversations because
exactly.
Of the Ireland.
Exactly.
Good. The Irish connection.
Thank you, Rich. You bring it all home, and that's why we love you. Thank
that's
you.
That's why you pay me the big money.
Just one of the reasons why we love you. Again, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we welcome you to check in. We love your letters for the most part. Okay. Let's talk about Brexit. We'll talk about the turmoil there. We've been talking about this all week. And every week or every day something new happens, and it's quite a, as one British tabloid put it, just monstrosity, I believe is how they describe the whole deal. Theresa May survives a leadership challenge, but the Brexit plan is still in peril. You'll remember yesterday that we were talking about Theresa May facing a vote of no confidence amongst her party, but she survived that threat to her embattled leadership on Wednesday, winning a party confidence vote and averting a leadership battle that threatened to plunge the country into prolonged crisis. So now they just have a little crisis, right? Maybe not as prolonged. I don't know. Doesn't look good, but this victory celebration, if any, is likely to be short-lived. While Mrs. May survived to fight another day, the future of her stalled plan to leave the European Union looked bleaker than ever. She still lacks the votes in Parliament to pass it. She stands little chance of winning the concessions from Europe that she needs to break the logjam. And the surprisingly strong vote against her within her own party underscores the difficulty that she faces in winning approval for any plan for Britain to leave Europe or Brexit as the deadline for withdrawal looms. That from the New York Times. Vera, let us go to you.
So I'm actually a little surprised she survived this vote of no confidence. It wasn't really a successful outcome for her in the sense that 117 MPs from her own party voted against her, which is, you know, pretty dramatic in terms of one-third of her own people did not support her. She's going back to Europe today to beg, in essence, for an additional clause that would guarantee that a harder border will exist between the Republic of Ireland and the British territory. Some Irish would say British-occupied territory of Northern Ireland. But that part of Ireland voted to stay in the European Union, as well as the majority of Scotland. So this has been an internal problem all along for Theresa May. So she's going to Europe. She's asking the European Union leaders to, in essence, come up with a new clause or some public assertions that they will not permanently allow Northern Ireland to be in the European Union and, in essence, allow for sort of a union, a political union between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, because obviously the whole vote of the Brexit was in favor of creating more sovereignty and control over British territory. So, in essence, the outcome has been difficult for Theresa May. She's going to request additional help from the European Union. They might give her some wording. It doesn't mean that the future for her looks any better. Now, she won't get another vote of no confidence for the same issue for another year, but it could still mean that her leadership role is diminished. She won't have support from her own party, and the opposition is obviously gunning for her. So I don't see this resolving anything at all.
So where do we go from here?
Well, she will see if she goes to the EU on this begging tour and comes up with some assertion, assertion for which her party can vote in favor of this Brexit deal.
So the question here is whether the EU wants them enough.
Yes.
To stay into the. Into the mix.
Well,
I
don't know that the EU even wants the UK to be in the deal anymore. They want some resolution. So that's some resolution that's ordered and not chaotic. And they don't want the UK to sort of drop off into this uncontrolled scenario. So I think the EU has the incentive to give her some assurances that she can take back to London and talk about how this border issue will be resolved and not permanently present a problem in terms of the questioning the sovereignty of the British government.
I mean, the irony is the plan's going to end up looking pretty much like her plan. There's really not much else. It's a hellishly complicated thing to split up, because the one thing I think all sides agree on is you don't want a quote hard border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, because in the past, you know, they haven't always, you know, done well together. So they're trying to soften that border, but that is effectively the border between, you know, the EU and the UK.
Right, because putting a hard border back in place looks an awful lot like the walls that used to be there and not so long ago, right, that everybody, you know, nobody wants to go back to those times.
Everyone agrees on that. Everyone agrees that they would like to avoid that, you know, for good reason. But I don't know how much different the plan can really be. You're right, maybe she'll get some wording. But it's going to end up looking pretty much like the plan is now. Mm-hmm. And she'll take the hit for it. But I think the other reason... I think one of the other reasons she survived the vote is if not her, then who?
Exactly.
And if not this plan, then what? If anybody had a better plan, they would have come up with it, and nobody does.
Can somebody bring us up to date on exactly what this compromise on the Irish border is?
My understanding, so far, the idea is, so you have Northern Ireland and Ireland, all mm-hmm. right? Ireland would be part of the EU. Northern Ireland is part of the UK. So would not be part of the EU. The border then between Northern Ireland and Ireland would become the border between the UK and the EU. And when we talk about a hard border, is are we really going to have remember within the EU there's this kind of no physical walls as well as no trade walls. So are we really going to have checkpoints and walls and police and things like that along that border, which nobody really wants. The problem then is if you're going right now. So what they're saying right now is, OK, we'll have a soft border and they're going to try and negotiate a, quote, free trade agreement over the next mm-hmm. couple of years to put the rest of it in place. But the EU says, well, we want some kind of backstop. We want to know what's going to happen while we're negotiating mm-hmm. that trade agreement, and if we don't. And that's what they've offered. They've offered this kind of customs border, but not a hard border. And I think that's the best they're going to do.
So another issue, of course, that really drives the Conservatives mad in London is the fact that if you have a soft border, which they don't want, is the fact that you can have immigrants, which the part of the Brexit vote was to control and decide who can immigrate and become a resident in the UK. But if you now are an immigrant to Ireland, the Republic of, and you cross the border that is soft into Northern Ireland, the British government wants to control who gets to live there and who gets to travel where. Part of the questions of sovereignty are also about controlling populations, who comes and who goes. So it's a question of control from the center, which is very difficult to achieve, as you exactly said, with the European Union not being interested in those kinds of questions, because the last thing anybody wants is a return to open warfare along that border.
Couldn't somebody give me an example of a soft border somewhere else?
Well, soft borders exist everywhere within the European Union.
Well, you can just pretty much move freely from place to place.
Well, I'm wondering about our relationship, for example, with Canada.
Well, that's not a soft border.
No.
That's a hard border.
So state to state is a soft border.
Right. Yeah. That's a good way of putting
okay,
it.
Okay. State to state is a soft border. Us in Canada is you know, a hard border.
That's
right?
A hard border.
I mean, it's an actual. And it's
Mexico,
and it's also.
Canada.
And for customs purposes
and tell,
as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. Look, it's not like the checkpoints, you know, in Gaza. Right. But that's what we're talking about. And it's also, Alan, it's not just the physical border. It's, you know, this whole idea of the kind of the customs union, like if you put the border somewhere else, you have this idea where you might have to pass customs sending something from England to Northern Ireland, which does, you know, across that sea, which doesn't seem to make sense. It's just a difficult thing. So that's what we're talking about with borders. You know, there are countries, too, that are part of. Now you're going to ask me a name on Turkey. Is Turkey, for example, is part of kind of the customs union of the EU, but is not part of the physical union. It doesn't have a hard border. It does have a hard border, but they have a trade agreement.
But that's it. Yeah.
It really comes down to I'm sorry, but it really comes down to the fact that they put something to a vote, the people voted it. And kind of know very few people in the government, A, want to do it, and B, kind of know how to do it. And
well, it's complicated. I mean, everybody knew it was going to be unbelievably complicated.
Yeah.
It was a sort of a nationalistic vote in the country, and a lot of young people did not step up or didn't understand that this was going to happen, in fact. And, you know, in essence, one alternative that could emerge if this situation blows up is that there is a re-vote. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine a re-vote.
And the polling is showing, if there is a re-vote, that the stay-ins are outnumbering the get-outs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's isn't that just a larger issue, though? And that's an issue. Those are issues that we have here as well.
Exactly.
This whole idea of, you know, there's people who think populism is good. You know, and there's people who think it's bad. And here, you know, the people have voted on something, and the government has basically dragged its heels, not without reason, because you're right, it's a terrifically hard deal to do, but and said, we kind of don't want to do this.
Yeah, and the other issue is that it wasn't really a vote in a sense, it was a referendum. So this is sort of outside of the framework of regular voting, which is also a question about how democratic is it in principle when you have, major decisions made based on. Are you okay?
Yes. Oh.
We had an incident in the studio, but. So, in essence, it is not truly democratic if you use a referendum, because that is outside of the democratic framework, when Parliament would have actually had a chance to discuss this issue and the public would have been more informed and accurately informed about this particular scenario.
Voting on something that you didn't really know how they were going to do.
Exactly.
I got to tell you, that's where I start to bristle, you know, as a conservative, because, you know what, they put it to a vote. They, people discussed it, and you know, this is what the people wanted.
But it's not what the people wanted.
But votes have consequences. You can't. You can't just say that because a vote turned out a certain way. No. Well, the polls show. As far as the only poll that really matters is the vote, and people wanted to leave.
Except
and it's
that,
dangerous to ignore votes. I think you have a real crisis of legitimacy.
Yeah. I'm not saying that. Yeah. Except for. It's a parliamentary democracy where people are expected to actually bring an issue in all its detail to public debate in parliament and to have special interest advance a referendum idea that then people aren't paying that much attention to and they don't know and they're not clear on how their own lives are financially affected, how the future generations are affected by this. It should have all been discussed. And we know we have a lot of evidence that shows that people were misled by a public campaign.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I just think there was, I mean, to say that people weren't aware of what the consequences could be or weren't aware of all the issues, that doesn't ring true to me because, I mean, this was the defining thing that was talked about in the country for months and months, if not a
then
year.
Why is there
leading
so much
up to the,
I understand what you're saying, and I fundamentally agree with you, but then why is there so much buyer remorse?
Isn't there always buyer remorse after? I mean, who's remorseful?
So
is it the people who voted to stay? Or, I mean, there's buyer's remorse over Trump winning.
Yeah, right, but it's not the people who voted for Trump. But we get to do it again in 4 years.
Yes. Yes,
and correct it if we so want to.
And there's one other essential difference because proponents of Brexit lie to the public, saying that they would save hundreds of millions of pounds by not paying into the European Union system, and that money instead would be used to invest into the national health system, which is number one, inaccurate, and number two, impossible to do. So they misled a voting segment about what was going to happen to their health plans, particularly older voters. And so that was really inadequately discussed.
Let's pause there. We have much more to discuss, and we will do that right after this short break. All right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Rich Honan, Vera Karius-Kelly, Chris Churchill, and Alan Chartok. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We did get letters, and we will go to those now.
All right. Michelle says, or Mickey says, easy solution for Brexit problem on Irish border. The UK should give Northern Ireland back to Ireland. No border needed. And by the way, I thought the same thing.
This is a sovereignty issue for the UK. You know, the Conservatives are going to have just a coronary if they think about giving back Northern Ireland.
Yeah, well, remember Winnie Churchill? You know, he wanted to. He didn't want to lose his empire, but he had to. Does anybody want to respond to that? No.
No.
Oh, Daisy says Brexit. My British and Scottish friends all say Brexit happened because the government ignored the struggling manufacturing north for the south, where all the money is in the banking industry. It's much like what is happening in this country and why we ended up with Trump.
It's also much like what's happening in France.
I thought you were going to say. It's exactly like what's going on in France with the yellow vests.
Yeah, it's happening all over the world, but France is the most dramatic example. Yeah.
And Chris, you are wrong. They were misled. The big selling point was that all this money was going to flow into national health. They had a bus promoting this idea, and this has never happened and won't happen. And that's from Daisy. Do you want to respond to Daisy?
No, not really. I mean, people are misled in pretty much every election you can think of. I don't know that alone is a reason. You know, if there's a campaign that's misleading people, it's up to the opposition to state the truth. My fear is that nullifying a vote is more dangerous than anything. Than pretty much anything else, because you really do. It'll be a crisis of legitimacy. If people will lose faith in the idea that their vote means anything.
So what about
that's ultimately more dangerous than anything Brexit can do.
So what about North Carolina right now? You see this guy,
But that's allegations of fraud. That's different. The North Carolina, is that what you're talking about? North Carolina congressional race.
That's entirely different.
There's allegations of fraud to the point where the GOP. whose candidate won said, yeah, we should, yes, that's a different thing. I think I agree with Chris. This whole idea of, you know, we have an election. We don't like the result. Oh, the people weren't smart enough. That's a terribly slippery slope.
It
and
wasn't...
we hear that everywhere now. And it's just not, it, you know, somewhere it says that governments gain their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Exactly, the consent of the governed in an election. I agree with you, in an election, not a referendum. A referendum is changing the future of all Scottish and Northern Irish people who, in fact, are in the minority community in the UK. And the English determine, once again, just like during colonial times, how the outerlying areas are supposed to be experiencing their future. Well, I think a referendum is a real problem.
There was a referendum to join in the first place.
Exactly.
So why did they bother to listen to that one?
And the government was the one who set the referendum. This wasn't a write-in campaign.
Well,
the government sensed the need and set up the referendum. And look, I understand if you have problems with the unwieldiness of the UK, I understand that. And some of those problems, you're right, those problems are historic, right?
Yes, they are.
You know,
and
I don't know that there's a good answer for that, but that's what you're dealing with.
Well, one of the issues is the referendum originally was about an economic union. So it wasn't about this entire larger project questioning sovereignty and independence issues.
You're saying that the Brexit referendum
the EU was on economic measures. So if you want to change something, you should negotiate out of it. You should pursue a public debate. You should have the parties be very clear on where they stand. And there should be a larger ability for the population to actually think about what the future looks like that is different from your future now. And then if it's an electoral process, I think it's perfectly fine to pursue, you know, either reforms, or which the EU obviously needs, or a separation. But the current process, I think, was mismanaged and is not profoundly democratic.
I think it was absolutely democratic and you just don't like the result.
Well, okay, it's just as democratic as having Saddam Hussein stand for an election and 90% vote for him. Yes, it's democratic. It's an election. I guess we could go with basic electoral processes. But, you know, I mean, referendums are not elections. Referendums are not elections where you have a process. You have lobbyists and special interests pursue a public relations campaign.
But that's true of elections, too, isn't it?
It's everywhere.
You know, as someone who lives in New York State, I wish we had a referendum process here.
Because me too.
Because there are all sorts of things that are blocked by lobbyists and big corporate powers that never come to light. If we had a referendum like California does,
Massachusetts
does, I think we'd get a lot of things done here that never get done.
So, but when you look
at I realize that there are dangers with the referendum processes. I realize that advertising can have too big of an effect.
Yeah.
That's true of almost any election that you can think about.
I hear you about that. In California, for example, you have a number of referenda that have been overturned. Now, you cannot overturn the Brexit divorce. That is the thing.
Well, the courts actually just said that you can, right?
Once the divorce...
The British courts said that the referendum, they're actually taking your view. They're saying the referendum does not need to be followed.
You
could argue
about
it. I don't think that's a correct decision, but that's what they've said.
We'll see where it all goes. But I think there are a number of avenues for Theresa May to pursue. I just think... the difference between California referenda and the kind of things that you're thinking of here in the state of New York are issues that are very specific issues that have been blocked for a long time. And I agree with you, for those issues, referenda are good. But in the larger sort of complexity of the European Union issue, I think it was a misstep, and it should have been at least discussed for a year to educate people about what the...
I thought it was.
Well, it wasn't really discussed publicly.
I thought that debate was going on for a while.
But. All right, let's go to some letters.
Jamie says, Brexit, why are they wasting time on fair land borders? In reality, there is no way out of the EU. If England leaves, it will have to be punished. And Great Britain's hopes of becoming one of the world reserve banks is living in the past. They reserve the economic size to be taken, they lack the economic size to be taken seriously, and their past actions manipulating currency values makes them suspect at best.
Well, you know, London voted, of course, against Brexit, and London is losing a fair chunk of its financial industry to Frankfurt, but also to Singapore, apparently.
And Mike says, Michigan and Wisconsin question for Rich Honan. Just heard Rich say...
We were 43 minutes in, and I had avoided everything up until now. Yeah, go ahead.
Just heard Rich say they had a vote, and this is what people wanted in regards to Brexit. So why are Republicans trying to interfere with the will of the people and vote in Wisconsin and Michigan?
I didn't think they were interfering. I thought that they were just
Wait.
You're talking about, I'm sorry, you're talking about the lame duck legislature?
Yes, okay. That's what we're talking about.
That's just wrong. I mean, that's just a wrong thing for them. So just so I make sure I'm understanding. No. In those two states, you have lame duck legislatures.
That's correct.
Where now power will change from a Republican to a Democratic
governor. No. I don't think that the legislature is going to change. The governor is going to change.
Did I just say from a Republican to a Democratic governor?
Go governor, I'm sorry.
It's like and being so what at they're home. Trying no to do. Oh, yeah.
Maybe there's a reason. Right.
So in both of those states, the governor is changing to the other party. The legislature is still of the party of the old governor. And so what they're trying to do in both of those situations, in different ways, is to restrict the powers of the incoming governor, which, first of all, I totally agree with the listener. I think that is kind of defying the results of the election. I think those legislators are terribly wrong to do that. I can't imagine that's consistent with the constitutions of each of those states. You know, I don't know them, but it just sounds like that's not something you can do. Absolutely agree. But that proves my point. They are trying through legerdemain to overturn the will of the people because they didn't like the result. If you're going to have a democracy, it's going to be messy and you're going to get results you don't like.
Okay, we agree. John says, Brexit. Dear panel, the Brits are most prolific immigrants throughout the EU. There are more Brits living in other EU countries than the reverse, and the number is only going to grow as major companies move their UK-based operations to mainland Europe. And if you It says, I'm reading it as it's written, and if you pushing the idea that all implications of leaving were clear at the time in the referendum, then why are they so seemingly confused now?
Well, because, I mean, this is one of those issues. I agree, that's a really big problem. People did not understand that if you take mobility away from professionals, that they will likely have to leave urban environments in the UK and go elsewhere. So you have a tremendous loss of physicians, nurses, and entire sectors are depleted in terms of expertise, and increasingly so because Europeans often used to go to the UK for jobs in those sectors, and now they're leaving. And so the British population, which imagined an improvement in its national health system, is now experiencing colony collapse.
Okay, so Marty says, the problem with Brexit wasn't under-informed public at all. The problem was that a plebiscite is really unfair as a method for the four countries of the United Kingdom, countries of the United Kingdom, because England, by a huge margin, is the bulk of the population, whereas in America, the tiny population of Alaska is overrepresented. Senate influence compared with California, people in Scotland and Northern Ireland and Gibraltar, et cetera, had ridiculously little say on their own destiny, and it's really not right at all. That's from Marty.
100% correct.
We said that earlier. We said, look, if there's always going to be that tension within the UK. That's just the makeup of their system.
How many more you got there, Alan?
Well, I got three.
Okay, so let's pause there. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll continue. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, listening to Bailiff Fleck. And, well, we're going to listen to your letters, too. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And here goes Alan.
Willard, Brexit. It's not true that the voters for Brexit were informed about the benefits or consequences, for the leaders of the Leave movement lied. That's from Willard.
Yes, they did lie.
And Vincent says, troops. Just a quick historical note, Britain still has the largest number of soldiers stationed in Northern Ireland than any other place in the world. Love your show. Vince from Kingston, New York.
Yeah, I did use the word occupation, did I now? Yes. I mean, Brits are often considered as an occupying force in Northern Ireland. Now, there has been accommodation of sorts, but, you know.
Dan says, Brexit. Rich hit the nail on the head. Do any of the opponents of Theresa May's Brexit plan think they would be able to negotiate a better deal with the EU? The EU holds all the cards. They don't have to budge, and they're not going to in a way. I'd like to see Theresa May just walk away and say to her opponents, okay, fine, you own it now, and then watch them crash and burn. And that's from Dan in Pittsfield.
Wow, that could be brutal, though, for especially retirees.
No, I think she's being amazingly patriotic. I think she's gonna swallow her pride and try and do whatever she needs to do to cobble this together. I think with the hope that they do get this FTA, the free trade agreement, in the next couple of years, which I don't know that she'll even have the chance to negotiate.
Oh, she has just barely a year left.
Yeah.
I think.
So, but I mean, I actually think, you know, years from now, people are going to say she was put in an impossible situation and did the best that anybody could.
But she willingly accepted that leadership position. She really wanted to be prime minister. So we got to recognize that.
But they kicked all the others out pretty much the same way when they tied it up.
Oh, I mean, you have to take a beating in that position right now. Absolutely. Yeah. And I agree with you. She's taking it daily.
I thought the high point was, did you see that one of the MPs stole
the mace?
The mace. Did you guys already talk about that?
That's just
terrific. There's this ceremonial mace, an actual mace, the weapon, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it is...
Not the pepper spray.
Right, not the pepper spray. And it is there in the chamber, and you cannot pass legislation. You can't take action unless it is in the chamber. And one of the MPs picked it up and ran out of the chamber.
Yeah, this is not unusual, right? This is a standard practice.
I didn't know they did that.
So because you cannot, that's why you don't, when you get deeply frustrated, you can express your frustration by taking the mace and removing it and disrupting the discussion, because that is one of the ways to which you can prevent actually other alternative expressions of anger.
There was a story related by, I think, Gore Vidal about Abraham Lincoln when he was in the state house in Illinois. Mm. Okay, so he was a state representative, and the state house was on the first floor, and he and eight other legislators were trying to not have a vote happen, and they jumped out of the first floor window so as to deprive them of a quorum.
But you remember when the state legislators, I think it was in Wisconsin, went into hiding for a little while so there wouldn't be a quorum, and everybody was trying to track them down and drag them back
to arrest. It's a long and storied history.
Yeah. So Peter says, hey, look, I agree with Rich, but... Rich says government gets the legitimacy from the consent of the governed, and therefore an election you don't like shouldn't have to have a do-over. So how come every time a corporation with economic interest, like, say, fracking or extending a license for a nuclear plant, loses a popular vote, they get to bring the issue back again and again and again in an attempt to exhaust the voters who have turned them down?
By the way, it's not just Rich. I kind of think that might be in the Declaration of Independence. Governments gaining their, or in the government, governments gaining their just consent from.
Well, I don't think that was the issue.
But everything that we're talking about are there's popular votes, and then there's the perversions of that. Right. And, you know, whether you say, well, people were lying when they got the vote, or people, you know, nullified the vote, or people lobbied to get the vote. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be that. It's always going to be a function of democracy.
And Josh says, Brexit. Hi, panel. Why not have a referendum on if the people of the UK want a revote? That's very funny.
Let's spend tons of money on the question if we want to have a revote. It's very funny. Yeah.
Roger says, Brexit. I've read that a key difficulty with the Brexit referendum, that it was not specific enough. The Remainers knew exactly what their vote meant, simply staying. The Leavers each voted for some varied idea of what leaving means. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's accurate.
Yeah. Okay. And then we heard from Jason, who said, bogus argument. The argument that the Brexit vote would be delegitimized by a second Brexit vote is ludicrous. If you believe that a vote has consequences, then why wouldn't the consequences of a second vote be illegitimate with respect to the first? Why is it not possible for the leadership to go back to the public and say, we've worked for 2 years on this and there is the reality of Brexit, it's not the same. It's not the same as what we promised. Are you, the public, still okay with the Brexit reality versus mm-hmm. the Brexit promise? How much of that is not democratic? Jason.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that. I understand that, but the problem is you still have this issue. What a vote was taken. People didn't like the result, and for whatever reason, the result has not been implemented. Now you could say, yeah, it's really hard to do. We see the same thing here. You know, in many situations. And, you know, the idea that, well, you know, voter fatigue and, you know, people will just kind of give up after a while. While I understand they have the right to go back to the public, I wonder if that then becomes the new strategy. You know, just keep voting and at some point they'll get it right.
Yeah. But, you know, go ahead.
I think you have to wonder where that ends, too, because, you know, say there is another referendum and Remain wins. Hmm. Well, in 2 years, do the people who wanted to leave, do they say, well, they were the people who voted for it were duped, with, you know, this wasn't a fair thing, and we're gonna have another election, just keep going and going and going? I mean, or do the elites just say, we're gonna have an election until we get the result that we want, and then it's done? I mean,
I think one of the issues to consider also was that the Brexit referendum was an exceptionally close vote, even though the English were clearly have the majority of the population. It was an exceptionally close vote. It was, you know, 52-48. So it's very, very close outcome. So next time around, if there's a next time, there better be more clarity. And that is the issue that has to be discussed publicly. And then there has to be an election to bring the actual party into a position of influence in parliament to then pursue an outcome that is renegotiated.
But
I think that
votes,
would be democratic.
The problem is all votes now are close. The schism between, you know, people do the math and they say, oh, you know, Trump got elected because of a few thousand votes. You know, if you pick out and say all votes now are close.
What do you mean all votes are close? In the Anglo-American environment, perhaps, but
sure,
all votes are not close everywhere, I don't think. I mean, I don't know what you're saying here.
I think votes have gotten so close, we've become so close to close elections that when you say 52-48, I think, wow, that was pretty decisive.
Yeah,
blow up.
Right.
Well,
you
know,
doesn't sound that close to me anymore.
I mean, everybody's within the margin of error now. Everybody within the margin of when you can ask for a recount. You know, how many times are we seeing that? I just think that's the polarity of
in
of
the
of
UK.
The population.
May I remind you, it was not close in Scotland and Northern Ireland. So those are the historical burdens that parliamentary governments have to keep in mind.
Hey, my historical burden is I'm a conservative living in New York. I'm never, ever going to, my state is always going to outvote me. But that's the path
the future
chose.
For Scottish and Northern Irish could include your inability now to travel to Europe and get a job and study there and pursue a future that you had before this vote, even though you didn't want to negatively have your personal mobility and your earning capacity influenced by somebody else's vote.
And
this is a big problem.
It is, but that was a known issue right after Brexit. And I think it was even discussed before Brexit that this would actually, some of the issues that would be brought up as they are, would actually question the fundamental system of the UK.
Mm-hmm. And all now right. We're moving on.
We have a minute until the break.
I'm loving this. I haven't gotten any negative emails yet.
I'll send you one.
String it out.
Want to get lobbyists out of
run out the clock.
Want to get lobbyists out of the equations? Implement campaign finance reform, and that's from Dave. And Stacy says, seriously? You guys are something. Just give Northern Ireland back to the Republic. In real life, Northern Ireland voted to stay with England. They don't want to go back. And do you know what the Irish people in the Republic think of the Northern Irish? Do you think they have any idea how serious this is for the country of Ireland? It doesn't sound like it. The Russians meddled in the Brexit vote just as they did with our presidential election. Many, many people reasonably question the legitimacy of both votes. And then we heard from Stephen. Wisconsin and Michigan lame duck shenanigans. Rich is a true conservative as he stands for the integrity of our painstakingly crafted institutions. Kudos from a tax and spend snowflake. That's from Steve. And we heard from Chris.
Tax and spend snowflake. Like yes, that. Go ahead.
We heard from Chris. Rich and Chris, thanks for making my Christmas wish come true. Chris and Rich on the same show. Awesome. And Michael said, Brexit, did the Russians interfere in social media to affect the original vote? That's what Michael said. And Anna Marie says, Prime Minister May, I agree with Rich. Theresa May is doing what there is to do for our country. She's incredible. And that's from Anna Marie.
It's 10 o'clock. Time now for news. I'm worn out. That was quite a project during the break. We were taking a photo. Apparently, Rich wants to send out his holiday cards and have a photo of all of us on it.
Really?
And happy holidays. It would have the whole roundtable family on it.
I need two forms of ID. Okay.
It started here in the studio, and I don't know, next thing we were in Scotia.
I'm worn out from that little promenade I had to do during the banjo.
Yeah, well, it's all good. So.
It's hard to do square dancing in this place.
Had to do.
We said you had to do it.
It's
good.
It's part of my gig.
Good point, Chris. All right. Let's see. Let's go on to other subjects. We have a lot of other stuff to talk about. We haven't even gotten to the hush money yet. So Michael Cohen, you remember who he is, right? Michael Cohen sentenced to 3 years in prison for crimes committed while working for the then-candidate Trump. A federal judge on Wednesday sentenced President Trump's former attorney Michael Cohen to 3 years in prison for financial crimes and lying to Congress as the disgraced fixer. Apologized, but said he felt it was his duty to cover up the dirty deeds of his former boss. Cohen made an emotional apology to the U.S. District Judge, taking responsibility for what the judge called a veritable smorgasbord of criminal conduct. Crimes that included tax violations, lying to a bank, and during the 2016 campaign, buying the silence of women who claimed that they once had affairs with the future president. And if that seems a lot, it is a lot, but not enough to buy you more than 3 years in prison, apparently. So, but he did cooperate. Now, on top of that story, there is also the story that the National Enquirer has also made a deal here. The National Enquirer, you will remember, with the revelation by prosecutors on Wednesday that a tabloid publisher admitted to paying off a Playboy model. Key participants in two hush money schemes say the transactions were intended to protect Donald Trump's campaign for president. That leaves Mr. Trump in an increasingly isolated and legally precarious position, according to election law experts. Hundreds of thousands of dollars in payments made in 2016 to keep two women silent about alleged affairs are now firmly framed as a legal campaign contribution. The news about the publisher, the parent company of the National Enquirer, came on the same day as Michael Cohen was sentenced.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I will never believe another thing I read in the National Enquirer.
Well, the National
Enquirer, or anything that Michael Cohen tells you.
The National Enquirer also released this absolutely fabulous magazine that encourages Americans to travel to Saudi Arabia as the up-and-coming vacation spot. Did you see that?
When did they put that out?
Just about a couple of months ago or so. Yeah, it came out and it was amazing. I mean, you would think
they also produced Trump Magazine at one
point. I don't mean to be elitist in any way, shape, or form when I say this, but how many people reading the National Enquirer are thinking about Saudi Arabia as a vacation destination?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, even if
you pick that as their target demographic,
right?
Well, I think there were payments
that would
going
be
back
a
and
nicer
forth.
Way of saying it. Okay,
there's all these. There will be inquiries into the question of payments, right? So why is it that the Saudis on the front page of that magazine, MBS appeared in his royal outfit, and he discusses all the reforms.
Honey, is it going to be Branson or Saudi Arabia this year?
I mean, I don't know. It was just the whole thing is fascinating. You know, Harold Painter, is that his first name? The constitutional scholar.
Oh, okay.
He mentioned that Trump is in serious trouble. you know, after this last release. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what comes next.
To me, the real question is whether the Justice Department is going to revisit their idea that a sitting president can't be indicted, because it's a ludicrous proposition. It's ludicrous because what you're saying is one person is above the law. Now, I think and by the way, we still haven't gotten to the Mueller stuff. We still don't know what he has. So all those people who were crazily saying impeach him now with whatever limited stuff you have, just a wrong. We were talking about 2 out of 3 in the Brexit referendums. Mm-hmm. You can imagine if you impeached him now in the House of Representatives, A, it would never pass in the Senate. They would never vote for it. So I think you wait.
You know, the thing, and you're absolutely right, that's certainly on the left, that is talking about the impeachment. I was listening to Fox Radio yesterday for a fairly good chunk of time, and there was somebody filling in for Hannity. But I was surprised that their narrative on this is that, but none of this has to do with collusion. None of this has to do with Russia. None of this has to do with anything that the special prosecutor was assigned to do. Therefore, it should just be dismissed as a sideshow. Which is what the president is saying as well.
Well, it's ridiculous.
But I mean, you know, this is an argument that in essence suggests that just because as part of the Mueller investigation, that when you discover potential criminal activity or activity that, it sort of interferes with the electoral process that is on the criminal end, that you ignore those issues because it may involve the president of the United States. That is so profoundly disturbing, this argument. Obviously, you have to pursue those areas as well. You might be able to. Mueller is obviously handing over some of those tasks to other courts, but you can't just ignore the fact when you find potential criminal activity and just move on and gloss over that.
The president did say yesterday that there's no reason you can't. He thought the people would revolt if he was impeached. And that he was the best president for the economy and was doing a great job, so there would be no reason to impeach him, was the statement I believe he made yesterday.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
I think he might be right there to a degree that if they impeached him now, there would be obviously a lot of
There's
still people who are ticked off about Nixon to this day.
Right. But I think you're right. I think you wait for the Mueller report and you see what's in there before you do anything on impeachment.
Yep. And we're on that path, and I think we now feel that it's definitely coming. I mean, in the next few months, we'll have more information, or by January, investigations will be initiated into certain business activities, and we will learn more and more about the entanglement between the Trump businesses and Russia. And so it's just a waiting game now. I agree.
Rich?
Yeah, I think, look, the Mueller report's going to come out. I don't think there's going to be any bombshells there. I think, obviously, this was, there was language inserted both into the plea agreements. You know, it doesn't escape anybody's notice who Cohen was represented by, a longtime Democratic Party and Clinton operative. And you kind of wondered what he was doing there. And now you realize they were there to insert this, this kind of new, this campaign finance count that doesn't seem to have anything to do with what he was actually sentenced for. This idea that you could have a prosecutor and a defendant making statements about a third party and attribute that to the third party, to me is makes the possibility of a crime fairly remote.
Does anybody
else
have to
wait,
clarification
you gotta wait for
on
the
that?
Report.
On which?
On what he just said.
Well, I completely disagree, but,
I don't fully understand what you're saying.
What they're saying is
names.
So you have a prosecutor.
Yes.
And you have Cohen.
Yes.
Okay. Cohen is making statements that are of no detriment to him, okay, and that I believe were inserted there at the behest of his alleged lawyer, Lonnie Davis. Lonnie Davis. And did not. I don't think that added to his sentence at all. I think there were gratuitous statements. So you're talking about statements by a prosecutor, and you're talking about statements by
defendant. Are you talking about, you know, like the mental and personal incarceration thing, or
no? The statements that I was doing this to protect the campaign, for example, and then the judge apparently making an actual finding that I find that this was done, you know,
right,
as a result of the campaign.
Exactly right.
That seems like an extraordinary finding to me to make without, you know, without the principal, you know, having been involved. But my bottom line is I agree with everybody else. We'll wait and see what Mueller says, and you know, then you know, the Democrats will go ahead with whatever they want to do. To me, it seems the possibility of an actual crime is incredibly remote, but you know, we'll wait and see.
Well, you know, the real question is anybody, do they really still prosecute people for campaign finance violations? The answer is it's very rare. And it's a hard thing to prove. And here's Trump. He's going to say, oh, yeah, no, okay, we put the money up to pay these two people, but we did it in order to protect my family. It had nothing to do with the campaign. He's going to say that. And if there's somebody sitting on that jury, you know, who believes it, case over. So,
except
and by
for,
the way, I disagree with you.
Today,
Rich,
we also have the National Enquirer story, right?
Yeah,
that is
Mr.
the
Pecker.
Issue, Mr. Petter, right?
Pecker.
So if
Pecker.
He, Pecker, sorry.
I can understand why you wouldn't want to do a vote saying that.
So he obviously also said he had additional information
right,
to show that it was a finance campaign violation. So
and
we'll
Cohn
see.
Said he had.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, does anyone really does the public care that much about campaign finance violations?
The answer is no.
Yes, I agree. Yeah,
they should, but they don't.
If indeed they existed, I don't know if they should. I mean, every campaign and look, if in fact. For you can show that that Trump knew this was a crime, intended to evade, knew it would be characterized as a campaign contribution, intended to evade the law, and went through all these machinations. Mm-hmm. That to me is a crime.
Well, look, the guy's a liar. We know he is a liar, right? We've known that from the very beginning. So now he stands up in that plane in that famous shot. No, I didn't know her. I didn't do anything with her. You know, all of that kind of stuff. Remember that impeachment was never designed just to be a criminal procedure. If the House of Representatives impeaches and the Senate convicts, it can be done because they don't like the way he's conducted himself, right?
Yeah, but in practice, it has only been for really, you know, infamous conduct.
Well,
right?
There are those of us sitting around.
You could
the
argue
table.
That Aaron Burr, you know, but you know,
there are those of us sitting around the table think this was terrible conduct. These last 2 years. Terrible, misogynistic and homophobic, and you name it, there it is.
There's what Congress can do, or what the House can do, and what politically they should do, right? I mean, I think if they did that, if they impeached him based on campaign finance violations, I think they would risk the same sort of backlash you saw in the late 1990s,
sure,
when Clinton was impeached. It's a dramatic and big step, and I think that the public expects there to be a dramatic and big reason to do it, not you know, not hush money for affairs and that sort of thing.
All right. So Alan has some letters, and then we'll go on to the Nancy Pelosi story.
Okay. So Deidre says, well-informed British electorate, how is the day after the vote? The most Googled question was, what is the EU? I believe the border between Norway and Sweden is an example of a soft border. And it's from Deidre. And Doug says, I think most of us have filled out forms or answered polls or other questions online. Most of these give you a chance to check your answers before sending. Are you sure? In my opinion, a follow-up referendum would be a reasonable thing to do now that Britain's citizens really know what's at stake. I'd love to do that with the 2016 elections, too.
Well.
And Matt says, Mueller's mandate. The order appointing Mueller specifically directs him to investigate crimes that may arise from the investigation. The argument that Mueller is operating outside his mandate is nonsense. And we heard from John, who says Trump's base. Hi, panel. I'm so baffled by the continued support of Trump by his base. The endless and regular disclosure of all the naughty and illegal stuff that has taken place around this guy is clear. Panel, please discuss this blind loyalty of Trump's base, especially given yesterday's pardon me, sentencing of Cohn. I am just baffled.
Well, the definition of, I mean, in a sense, the definition of base is almost blind loyalty. I mean, that's what your base is. It's the people who are most committed to you. Mm-hmm. And bases don't disappear or dissipate easily. I mean, I think you saw the same thing with Clinton in the 1990s. His base mm-hmm. stuck with him. Bases stick with the people that they support. That's.
But that's also because they've espoused some, the person about whose base you're talking has espoused some ideas that are just consonant with what right. the base likes.
I'm not even sure that's true. It's almost tribalism at this point. I think that he's your guy.
I'm sure it is for
and,
some.
And it's almost you hate the people who are going after your guy more than you even like your guy.
I agree there's a large percentage of probably everybody's base, right? And it's not just for individuals, right? There's probably a large percentage of Republicans who if a Democrat says something, it's wrong. And yeah, I absolutely believe that.
But I happen to believe that this goes back to my concept of the long discredited concept of national character. I think the national character in this country is made up of two different major groups of people. So when you have a president who is misogynist and xenophobic obviously has problems with people of color, there's a group of people in this country, very disturbingly, who are very happy with that. That's what I'm worried about.
So can I make another suggestion?
Sure.
I really think the moment the base will begin to reflect is when and if the economy starts showing some really some signs of real struggle. I think if there is no trade agreement with China and the consequences are felt very directly throughout the Midwest, that is when we begin to see that base to shrink.
That is the only factor
that will make a significant difference.
Hmm. I hope you're right. I just don't see that. When Hitler committed suicide, Germans said, "You're not allowed to talk about Nazism. We're going to denazify the entire country," because they're so sure there was a committed base that would never get off of that.
Well,
right?
I think this comparison is really not valid at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's just you're talking about two different historical periods, two different environments. I mean, I think this is not comparable.
Okay, so
I'm also not sure that I agree with you when you say that the base is necessarily made up of misogynistic and racist people. I mean, I think that if Marco Rubio was the Republican president, I think the base would be largely the same group of people. There may be elements of Trump, and especially in his most vocal or enthusiastic supporters who are racist and misogynistic, but I to characterize the entire base that way, I think is misguided.
I think you're certainly right to characterize the entire base that way, but I certainly think that there is a common thread that goes through that base and why, and I think it comes right out of the history of the Civil War in this country, and who was left in the South and what their belief system was. I'm sorry, I know that this is not popular with either of you, or even the three of you, but I feel very strongly about that.
I think that's a tremendously unnuanced analysis. I think I would challenge anybody who has that kind of analysis to use a little bit more intellectual rigor. I think that...
Who are you calling on intellectual?
I think that there's crackpots on every side. Absolutely.
That's what Trump said and got into a lot of trouble for saying that.
Well, but there are crackpots on every side, right? There's people at the far ends of
isn't that false equivalency?
No.
No, well, Trump was talking about Nazis versus people who were protesting against Nazis.
Yeah.
Rich is talking about Republicans and Democrats. I mean, it's a different.
I think one of the things that I've been on the show a million times when guests have actually said, "Rich, just and not in an acrimonious way," have said, "Explain it to me. I don't even get it. What is the attraction?" And And my response is, my response is the same as the response to you, Alan. It's not, you know, I don't think it's racism. I don't think it's xenophobia. I think that there are some principles that he espouses that are very fundamental and with which I agree. And, things like smaller, you know, very, very
smaller,
everyday
things.
Out of
sight budget. We have the deficits.
Agreed.
That we can't even
believe. But things like less governmental intrusion, things like, you know, yes.
I feel like we have a
borders.
Huge conversation coming up, but we only have 50
but
seconds.
Point is at least give us the credit of saying we're allowed to agree with some of the ideas without being racist and without being stupid and without being deplorable. And I feel like you don't
one of
that.
The things that I think is fundamentally causing polarization in this country is that an entire population group has been marginalized by globalization policies that emerged during the Clinton years. And they're now suffering and they're fearful and they're self-interested. Who isn't self-interested in terms of their economic survival and their own future?
Tell
I mean,
that
this
to David
is
Duke.
Part of this is part of what's happening in this country. This is part of what's happening in the UK. People are worried, especially people in certain sectors are worried about that, what their future looks like. And then there are, of course, other factors. But as long as we don't deal with economic processes that have undermined the confidence of certain groups in the population, we will face the polarization and the hostile and often sort of, you know, xenophobic kinds of languages, which sometimes merge with
that.
All
right, we are out of time. My thanks, everybody. We'll be back after this. Yeah.